Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website.
In my own sort of way, I'm not going to give you a lecture on history or why we're good, so I'm going to give you a rundown of my term as I remember it, what I know about them. And indeed, there will probably be enormous gaps, some of which my term mate Jack can fill in better than I can. But I think, as a result of what I say, we'll get some sort of picture of what a career in the Navy was and how it affected one batch of 12 young men. And before I start on the 12 young men, I think, get the thing in perspective too. The Naval College has had a fairly checkered history. When they decided to set up a Naval College in Australia, they had no place to put them. Jervis Bay was to be the site, it wasn't built. And they sent them after a lot of discussion, and they had all sorts of ideas in those days, but they finally started the place in, as most of us know, Osborne House, Geelong in Victoria. The first entry joined in 1913. And that, of course, is significant to the REN, is that we know that this year of this century, 1977, means basically the oldest Australian naval officer trained at the Naval College is 77 years old. In fact, he's 78. Sir John Collins, who was born in 1899. Now, after a couple of years, Jervis Bay was ready and the college was moved there. That became its home, and we produced some remarkably fine terms and some remarkably fine people. In 1922, it was the first of the big financial panics, and the Navy was cut in size, as was college as a part of it. From 1922 onwards, there was a fairly continual discussion of the fate of officer training in the REN and of where it should be conducted. And all sorts of ideas were produced because Jervis Bay was a very expensive place to run. They had to bring the coal in, had its own powerhouse, supplied all its own services and that sort of thing. And to train a comparatively few young men made it cost per capita very great. They had ideas of one stage of making it into a greater public school. Fee paying. Everybody who joined there would have to pay fees. They had the ideas of combining it with Duntroon, either at Jervis Bay or at Duntroon. They had ideas of bringing a power line in from Port Kembla to reduce the running cost. They had ideas of going straight to the British Navy's idea of not a special entry, but what did they call them, Jack? The ones they brought into the age of 17. They were Tricklands anyway, who'd done all their academic training and they were sent to the Erebus in those days and later the Frobisher, a training ship, did their midshipman's time and then joined up with the Dartmouth boys in whatever ships they were sent to or on sub-lieutenant's courses and so forth. They wanted the same sort of, a possibility of the same sort of idea for Australia. They had another idea where we'd just recruit them and send them over there anyway, send them to the Erebus and then send them to Dartmouth and finish their training there. All these things went on and there was a lot of discussion, and indeed in those days probably one of the best supporters was old Cappy Parker, father of Michael Parker and of course his other son in the Air Force and his other son in the Navy, who left the Navy as a sub-lieutenant, I think it was, in 1946 or 47. But Cappy Parker did an enormous amount of good in reviewing all the possibilities, in reviewing everything that had ever happened before, and indeed getting the Defence Minister and the Naval Board of the time to say that the scheme of training the REN had set up was the only scheme of training that would suit Australia, because we had produced in our own Naval Training College an individuality which was special to Australia, which you could not reproduce by sending them for training in another country. And indeed, we had the naval flavour there, and several things had proved that our naval officers trained through the college system were good, so you didn't want to combine it with the Army. And indeed, Navy and Army training don't, and didn't then and don't now, combine very well together in those early stages. So it went on, and then the Depression came, and the first result of that was the term of 1929, or the term that was selected in late 1929, were not initially put into college. The government weren't sure whether they were going to pack up training or what. They had other ideas of packing it up and sending the boys off to finish training in Duntroon or places like that. But in the end, the 29 selections went in as the Cook year of 1932. In August of 1930, the great decision was made that we could not justify the cost of operating Jervis Bay as an officers' training school. And it was announced in about June or July that when they went on the August leave, they would leave from Jervis Bay and they would rejoin the new college in the old warrant officers' quarters in Flinders Naval Depot. And that move indeed was made in August, September of 1930. 1931, there were no entries made to the Naval College. 1932, the normal time, no entries. But towards the end of, or no, I'm sorry, about July 32, the situation was reached and they began to realise that something must happen if we're going to keep a viable Australian Navy and keep viable training going. And a call was sent out then for entries to the Naval College within the age bracket of 14 and 15 years old to cover the two-year gap which they'd left in 1931 and 32. Some 720 young men applied, or boys, whatever you'd call them, and of that 720, 24 were selected. Of the 24 selected, the 12 oldest became the Jervis year of 1932. And we joined the Naval College in September 32, and our first year was catapulted, or foreshortened, into 3 months. And in January 33, we became the second year. The remaining 12 joined in January 33 and became Cook year, I think. And they carried on. Now, the people I'm talking about, the Jervis year, the senior boys, are Bassett, Brown, Crabb, Dollard, Dovers, Fenner, Gay, McMurray, Mears, Musard, Penny, Stevenson. That was our 12. The junior 12 were Brazier, Burnett, Catlin, Davies, Davis, Johns, McFarlane, Seddon, Shimon, Trelaw, Wheel, and Wells. And we'll deal with them because I think, by a quirk of fate, all those 12 oldest boys who went to the Naval College were born during World War I. But none of the ones who went in that entry in 1933 were born during World War I. Wells, the oldest, was born about a week after the end of World War I on the 18th of November. So I suppose you can say the story of the Jervis year, the one we're talking about, begins in autumn of 1916. And the first signs of the Jervis year emerged on the 22nd of January 1917 when D.W. Musard was born. It carried on then during the war until David Stevenson, the youngest member of our term, who was some 20 months junior to me, was born in August of 1918, the 16th of August 1918. Of those boys, the 12 of us, we're a fairly strange combination in some ways. Seven of us came from state schools, five came from public schools. Now, I've got to check occasionally, you'll forgive me. We were six Victorians, Bassett, Brown, Crabb, Gay, McMurray and Musard, three New South Welshmen, Dovers, Penny and Mears, two South Australians, Fenner and Dollard, and one Queenslander, Stevenson. It's interesting that Steve, of course, whose father had previously been, I think, the Bishop of Grafton, or a high church dignitary in Grafton, was in fact, at that stage of his life, a New South Welshman for a while. Of our parents, there was a fairly odd cross-section, I suppose. Two were sons of war widows. One was the son of a serving naval engineer. One was the son of a church dignitary. Another one had a father who'd served in the Navy, both the British and Australian Navy, but had retired by the time John Crabb joined the Navy. Three came from rural areas. Bimbo was one of them, or Jack, Farmer Jack as we called him in those days. And another one had an academic father, Fenner, whose father was a professor in the School of Mines in South Australia. One had a father who'd been with Mawson to the South Pole as a surveyor. That was Dover's father. And if you've been counting, you'll find that's 11. The 12th one's me. My father was a merchant service engineer who had his arm twisted and swallowed the anchor about when I was about 2 years old and became a power station engineer. Never went to sea again except in boats. So there you be. Combination, church dignitaries, academics, farmers, surveyors, you name it. Professionals. Oh, another one. I have left one out. One, Penny, his father was a leading solicitor in Sydney. So we were a diverse bunch of young fellows. The age span of 20 months I've mentioned. A great spread of family background. No obvious reasons in most cases for wanting to join the Navy. I don't to this day know what put it in Jack's mind. I know... Well, there you be. Well, I can tell you why I joined the Navy. In the same way, we were fallen in. At that time, I was at Hampton Higher Elementary School in Victoria. And the headmaster cleared lower deck of, which he didn't call, of course, but all the boys were falling in the quadrangle. And he said, the Navy is advertising for young men. He said, I believe this is a fine career. The Depression's on. You won't get anything better. Any volunteers? And there were. So this volunteer borrowed somebody's bicycle, screamed home, said to my mother, I'm going to join the Navy. Your mother said, you're not. Wait till your father comes home, see what he's got to say. And that is true. So I stacked on the usual young act and sort of got on this friend's bicycle and rode back to school and came back that night. And Dad said to my mother, I heard him say it. I was hiding in the kitchen. He said, let the boy go, for he hasn't got a hope in hell of qualifying. So my application went in. And we did the things, the academic thing, we did the interview, we did the medical, and then we sat back and waited. And I waited, and another gentleman in my school, Brazier, who was a member of the 33 class, was told that he had been selected for the Navy. So I sat back for a couple or 3 days and said, I've had it. Until a telegram arrived at the school, so asking the headmaster to inform one muster that if his parents didn't hurry up and produce his birth certificate, he wouldn't be in the race. Well, my birth certificate was, and I wanted it the next day, my birth certificate was in Semaphore, South Australia. We were in Brighton, Melbourne. My father telegrammed my uncle, who shot through to the registry, picked it up, gave it to the driver of the Melbourne Express. Dad was waiting on Spencer Street Station, picked it up, got in his car, drove to the Navy office and beat it by 1 hour, so I was in. That was all right, so I knew I was going for it. Then came the day, about the 13th of September, as I remember, Jack, and sort of we were told to report to that place in the Bluestone building in St Kilda Road in Melbourne, and there we were ushered into a room, and there were 12 young men looking at one another, thinking, what in the hell's all this about? Some of them did know one another because Steve had joined up with the Sydney contingent in Sydney and had come down by express train overnight, so at least they had that in. The rest of us had no ideas. I think that day, the wag of the term, Willie Gay, bestowed the first nickname when he picked on my poor fellow engineer, John Mears, and called him Bleary on the spot because poor Bleary had a bit of a hang lead, and so he always had this all his life until he was killed, this thing, but he became Bleary that day. Well, so we got down to FND, where we were met by two gentlemen, Simmet, the elder, and George Fowle, cadet captains of the senior year who'd been dragged back, as was the custom in those days, 1 week early from leave to look after these new sprogs and to give us some idea of what it was all about before the term masters and the rest of the cadets came back and we'd have some chance of survival. So for 1 week we were there, we were treated fairly kindly, except that Bertie Bassett and I found that we apparently didn't meet up with the system, and I think we started comparing notes then to how many times we were beaten per day and per week. Bertie was winning at one stage. In 3 months, he'd been beaten 365 times, or had 365 beats, and I'd only had 364. But we liked it. You know, it was part of the system. In fact, I got a feeling that Bertie and I were really egging one another on just to see what would happen. So that was that. We had a week, and then the rest of the college came in, and we became then, for 3 months, members of a naval college which had 36 members. The Cook year, the year ahead of us, my fag, at this time the fag master system was in, but only after a fashion. I'll tell you about that. And so we had the Cook year and then the Flinders year, I think, ahead of them. Philip. Now the members there, I could recite them, but I won't. But the senior boys we joined were Brewster, who became a torpedoman and finally became ordnance inspection. Downs, who left the Navy almost as soon as he left the college. I think trained as a bank fellow, then went to New Guinea and joined the public service up there as a patrol officer, and finally became one of the best district administrators they've ever had and a member of parliament, and was a member of parliament for some 10, 12 years until independence. Cruish, navigator, who died 10 years or so ago. Maxwell, my senior fag master, who left very shortly after he left the college, and he joined the British Colonial Service and was a patrol officer, district officer in the Solomon Islands. McCartney, who became a paymaster. MacDonald, the Black Prince, the eldest MacDonald, brother of the twins Neil and Hugh, who was the chief cadet captain and in charge of things. A gentleman called McWilliam, who became an observer, was killed during the war. Scotto, who was killed. Tapp, who went through, retired as a captain, died about 2 years ago. Wheeler, a torpedoman, who was killed in one of the British tribal class destroyers, as I recall. Williams R.L. Bungie, who was one of my particular friends in later years, but who left the RAN having married an English wife and ran a very fine pub in England for some years, and then became a member of the personnel organisation of the Bristol Aircraft Corporation. And Leslie Lloyd Williams, who was the engineer of that term. The next term, our junior fag masters, and indeed the term with which we had most to do for many years, were Bergen, who became a torpedoman, Cook, Bill Cook, who was later my captain during the war, Hinchcliffe, who was my junior fag master and became my eldest son's godfather, Jellicoe, who went to sea, flopped, and indeed flopped so badly that the Australian Navy would not take him on as a reservist during the war, and he joined the British Reserve Navy and served very well. Folkard, who unfortunately did in his back in a long jump or something sometime during his career, and the doctors could never find anything wrong with him. He became quite a cause célèbre. And although he passed out, he did not attend the passing out parade, and he did not go to sea. And because of that simple fact, that term was not the first term to leave college intact or to go to sea intact. That honour rested with my term, our term. Anyway, that was Folkard. Folkard joined the army, served very well, came back, and was a bank manager and a very healthy man. All he had was a slip disc, but they never found it. George Fowle. And George was a gunner, dagger gunner, and he stayed on in the Navy, Director of Weapons, and then he went to the Department of Supply. He retired as a captain or an acting captain. Milner, who became the harbour master, he left as a sub-lieutenant. He served in the reserves during the war, became harbour master in Rabaul, and indeed may still be there, to my knowledge. Peel, Eric John, who was made captain, retired some 6 or 7 years ago. Purvis, IK, torpedo anti-submarine, retired about 3 years ago as a Commodore. Ramsey, currently Sir James Ramsey, Governor of Queensland, left the Navy as a Commodore in Western Australia. Robertson, RJ, K, captain of the Melbourne and retired from the Navy as a captain as a result of the Melbourne Voyager show. And Tim Sinnott, the elder Sinnott, the brother of the present Chief of Naval Staff, who was a gunner also. So those people really had most to do with our upbringing. We got to know them pretty well. No, that's for sure. Now, more importantly, not only did we not like them, but we hated their term officer with a deep-dyed hate. Their term officer was a gentleman called George Scott Stewart, and who had a certain reputation through the Navy. However, when we joined the Naval College, I told you we made 36. There were two term officers there. That was the staff, officer staff of Naval College. It had been Freddie Nuts Cook, the elder Cook, as a lieutenant in command. He had relieved a fellow called Miller, who a lieutenant commander, who moved the college down from Jervis Bay to FND. And Copper Morrow was there as the second wing. So you had Cook and Copper Morrow as the term officers for our first few months there, when Copper disappeared to sea and was replaced by our favourite man, one John Plunkett Cole, who was probably the finest term officer that any term of young men could have had in our early training. Plunk was always there. He had that quirk. He could lift his eyebrow. I wish I could, but I can't. He was kind. He was unmarried, had plenty of time for us, therefore. Had a couple of girlfriends. They were always good-looking. He was the most dapper man, the most beautifully dressed man I've ever seen, and indeed sort of gave us the same enthusiasm, even as youngsters there. And so we lived with him. Then Gellatley came as a term officer as the college started growing. George Scott Stewart I've mentioned, and then finally Plunkett left and was relieved by the man who became our second term officer, and probably the best thing that could have happened to the older young men that we were, one Arnold Holbrook Green, the famous gentleman. Probably the most famous character this Navy has ever known. Arnold also unmarried. Arnold also had the gift of the gab. Arnold had it, you name it. He had money, he had clothes, he had motor cars, and he had personality. He could charm the tail off anything. Quite incredible man. And indeed, I think at that stage, in my book, he has always been one of the reasons why our term, one of the reasons why our term got where it did. And yet there were certain members of the term who weren't terribly keen on him. Other people who were around at the time, we had an RN captain of the depot, or Commodore, Sarrell, who had a daughter called Erica, who was greatly beloved, or was Willie Gray beloved of her, or the other way around, I'm not quite sure. We had old Popper Ross, the engineer commander down there, with two daughters. Sarrell was relieved by another RN captain, Franklin, who had the most beautiful, charming wife, the most gracious lady I've ever met. We had old George Stubbs as our parson. He was relieved by a fellow who taught me a little bit about the church, one Henderson. I remember going to Evensong one night in the chapel there, and old Bishop apparently was late off the golf links, so he just put his surplice on over his plus fours and still had his golfing boots on. But still, you know, we said the officers, and it was all nicely done. We had at the college the man I'll never forget, old Taft Thomas, our chief petty officer, one of nature's gentlemen, taught us how to sew sails and bags. He was always there if we were in trouble. There was another bloke we didn't like very much, but I realised in the past he was good for us, that fat, rather bloated-faced fellow, pasty one, chief petty officer. There was our chief steward, who was Malt, a most fantastic man. He'd do anything for we boys. Dark, very sallow little man. It didn't matter. You had no money. You had postage stamps. He'd sell you what you wanted, or he'd get it for you. If you were, as I frequently was, put in the corner to eat bread and water, and he'd find something and shove it round the corner so you wouldn't go quite hungry. We had the old boy Goodwin down at the stables, who looked after the depot horses, and indeed, sort of, you know, it's not that long ago when you think of it, that not terribly long before we got to the thing, the officer of the day used to do the rounds of the depot boundaries on horseback, 1930-31. And they had the stables there, and Goodwin ran them. He became the gardener, the college gardener, and was also a good friend of we boys. We had a signalman there. Oh, yes, quite, yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, then we had another one, the signal chief there, Cy Page. I think he was only a PO in those days. He used to make us march around carrying flags, pretending to be warships and learning what it was all about. But Cy Page, I saw him at Anzac Day last in April, looking just the same as ever, except a bit more wrinkled. That's the sort of people we had. They were hand-picked. Now, the other thing which was interesting about Depot, particularly towards the end of our time, 35, was that they'd also started to liberalise on general recruiting to the Navy, and you had all these youngsters coming in from Civvy Street who hadn't been able to find jobs across the Depression. And indeed, one of the reasons why the RAN was so good during World War II is we had this backlog of young men who were coming in with intermediate and leaving certificates, serving on in the Navy. They were there as leading rates when the war started, and they were ready to be made petty officers and chiefs. We built the minesweepers and boats like that, and we had ready-made senior crews to put into them. These were some of the benefits of a thing like the Depression, if you can call them benefits. But we did. The Navy was a very fine place because of this whatnot selection they were able to make. And indeed, I'm not at all sure that this is one of the principal things, or one of the first things to emerge with the Jarvis year and the year that followed them. That you have 720 applicants and you only want 24. You've got a pretty good choice. You can look them over pretty thoroughly. And they didn't make many mistakes in people they selected. They made one mistake in the term junior to us, I think, a young fellow called Catlin. It doesn't matter, it won't hurt him, but poor old Catlin, quite incredible customer, Queenslander. And he arrived at college wearing a football jersey, football shirts, pair of sneakers, and with long hair. And when he got there, he was asked what all this was about. And he said, because his uncles had told him it was cold in Victoria and he'd better wear his hair long, otherwise he'd catch a cold. And what about the clothes? He said, uncle said the Navy pinches all your clothes and mum said you better wear your old ones, Tom. So Catty arrived, you see. And indeed, this is true. So Catty lasted 3 months and then went. But somewhere, I think somebody must have read the piece of paper upside down or something of the sort, and some other deserving young man missed out. Anyway, so here we are at college, and I'm just giving you ideas now what I remember. I'm looking for quirks of fate, and there are a number. My term mate John Mears, who became my fellow engineer, we trained together in England at Keirn for 3.5 years. He was the son of the naval engineer. John assured me so many times that I've got to believe that it was true, that when the results were first published, he was not selected, and his father asked for a recount. And on the recount, John was selected and came there. We trained together, we volunteered together for engineering, we went to England, we served, as I say, 3.5 years in Naval Engineering College. We left England to come back to Australia, and as when we left Keirn, I was told that I was going to HMAS Perth and John was told he was going to HMAS Canberra. We arrived in Australia, we were met at Port Melbourne by Arnold Holbrook Green, who in the meantime had married John's elder sister, or John's sister, the eldest of two, and old Captain Mears, and I was told that sort of there'd been some changes made. They were sure I wasn't mine. I was going to the Canberra and John was going to the Perth. So I said, I didn't mind. I knew the Canberra. I'd been in there as a cadet, and I felt it was good to start off in the older ship and work up to the more modern one. Well, you see, I'm here. John wasn't. John went down with the Perth. These are quirks of fate that come in. And I think these are some of the things, when you're looking at this year of ours, strange things that happened. We left Naval College and went to sea with three of our members accepted as engineers, Mears, Musserid, and H.D. Stevenson. And H.D. Stevenson opted out of it on advice from the captain of the depot and on advice from his own father. And ultimately the board agreed. They wanted the engineers because they had taken none from the term ahead of us and we were terribly short at the time. Anyway, Steve opted out, so there's one of the steps on his way to becoming chief of naval staff. If he'd become an engineer, he couldn't have done it. So there we be. That's one of the quirks of fate. I suppose another quirk of fate was having in swift succession two people like Plunkett Cole and Arnold Green as our term officers. Then more importantly, in the last 18 months there, that our captain was again one of the Navy's top men, Heck Waller. And I don't think anybody in that college could have said a bad word against Heck. We all loved him like a brother. And indeed, he behaved like one, charging around in a baby Austin, chasing rabbits around the road, taking us out shooting in Boney Owl, how to shoot, how to gut, how to cook a rabbit, you name it. Arnold Green, take us over to his father's bungalow at Mount Eliza Way, Dramana, and his sister had come down and cooked for us, his father had come down and sort of bring all the food. Arnold produced the guns and the cartridges, and indeed, sort of only put a foot wrong once when sort of the old man had one of those old Edison cylindrical gramophone things, and Arnold used the cylinders as pigeons. Papa wasn't very amused. But anyway, there it was. We were over there. We were given a free go. Those who wanted to break out of the house of a night and go down to the pub and have a couple did so. I'm glad. Only two or three did. Maybe the others too scared. But there was something. I mean, there was this treatment, sort of the loving treatment, really, that was behind it. I mean, Arnold took us everywhere. He came there. Now, the other thing, we got to FND. Apart from the depot transport, I can remember Jackie Tate, our first captain, who left after about 3 months, had a little green wasp back thing called a jowet, which we had to push to start, the only motor car in the college. Titch Gellatley arrived, and he had one of those sort of 150cc Panzer motorbikes. Schoolie Rednall arrived down there in about our third year with a brand spanking new Austin. And it was the joke of the depot. He drove it for 12 months before he found out it had four gears. Nobody had told him. He'd been driving in three gears for a year. But they were the cars. Arnold Green arrived, and I think his first effort was the Cadillac. He wanted something to carry his term around, us, 12 of us, so he bought a long-based Packard. With seating room, we used to go to the local orchards. He'd sort of sort out with the people, and we'd be able to pick the fruit and take it back and stow it in the dormitories. Then he bought himself a Black Hawk Stutz, which was even more fun. And then he bought himself some American Terraplane, I think it was, with an aluminium cylinder head, which he used to charge around. I don't remember Plunk having a motor car. George Scott Stewart certainly didn't have a car in those days. I can't remember more than about three or four cars in Flinders Naval Depot. So, now what other, who have I forgotten? Now, schoolies, good people. Bill Cowan, the headmaster, wonderful fellow. And indeed, in that year, 1934, when Einstein's theory of relativity was announced, Bill Cowan was one of a dozen people in Australia who not only read it, but understood it. He was our headmaster. His second Dickie, Eldridge, Bulge, known all his life at the college as Bulge, wrote the only authentic history of the Naval College, published in 1945. Bulge Eldridge. Jeffy Aidney taught us French and things like that. Nice little man, prim and proper, tried to teach us straighten up our handwriting even. I can remember him leaning over my shoulder and throwing stripes and say, "Follow those lines, Mazur," and I saw one in his funny little voice. Simpson, Mad Mick, who taught us chemistry and things like that, who became a headmaster in his own, or the director of studies in later years. Mad as they come, but a thorough gentleman, and dedicated to us. That was their life. That if those were the days when, if a college officer was married, apart from those civilian schoolies, he wasn't allowed to have his wife closer to FND than Melbourne. A lot of the depot officers were stuck with Frankston, but the college officers, Melbourne, was the thing set down for them. Then we had the other dedicated bunch, the people in the depot themselves. William York de la Roche Beverley, RN Commander, fantastic man with the most beautiful wife, who was amateur dramatics. Remember they put on the ghost train, a couple of other things like that? We used to go to the drill hall, follow them up. Kenny Walton, who married his first wife in that period, she used to attend the hops. Sarrell's poor B.O. Admiral Captain Sarrell's daughter's governess, who was a very nice girl, but she, afraid, was known as B.O. and that was it. But she came to our dances and helped. Bulge used to bring sort of his daughters over from Frankston, Kanga and others, and some of the girls from Toorak College. Arnold Green used to import somebody in occasionally, but the worst part really was, you know, when there weren't any girls and you had to dance together. And I indeed, I mean, this is the first time I really stood up for myself in the Navy, because I had learnt to play the piano. Now, I'd given it up for reasons of my own when I was about 14 years old and determined never to play it again, and a gentleman called McCartney beat my bottom at Naval College and said, "You will play the piano." I said, "I won't. Sorry." So that was my first fallout, and I didn't, but Willie Gay played it. John Mears played the guitar, and we had somebody else who learnt to play the thing, so we had our own music. And then we'd have to dance together. And so there, and we had the two Cadillacs there. And if we had to go to play football in Melbourne, we got into these old sharabangs, so they carried about 16 or something. I thought it was a big one and a little one. And who was the old, our driver, whose daughter is still down there, teaching it, or was down there 10 years ago, teaching at the Crib Point High School?
Collier.
Joe Collier. Yeah, Joe Collier. Yeah.
He was down at
the old Collier. Yeah, he was, and went to FNB with
him. Went to
FNB. Yeah. Yep. Well, Joe was one of nature's gentlemen. He was probably the best thing that could happen to us young men. I mean, not a spark of vice in him, you know, just a kind fellow who would do anything he could to help these cadets. No. So there we were. We went through those years, and so then came, 34, and there was great whatnot, because if you recall, that's when the Spanish Civil War started, and of course the buzz went straight away, stop working, boys, you're going to go to sea, because that had happened once before, we believe. So reading our history, it didn't really happen that way, and indeed we didn't go to sea either, so we had to start work again. And then of course came August of 1936, and something else happened. We thought we'd go to sea.
Abyssinia.
And that didn't happen. We had to finish our courses. Well, a lot of us didn't work quite as hard as we should have. But we all got out. We all... Anyway, we passed out intact. I think we passed out one of the happiest terms. We certainly passed out...
probably a quirk of fate, too. It looked like there was going to be a war, and they weren't going to pay it.
Yeah, this could be... this might be a quirk of fate, yeah. So we went to sea. And we joined the Canberra in Sydney on January, I think, the 18th, 1936. I think Cockatoo was up in... Canberra was up in dock in Cockatoo. We all foregathered in Bill Dover's sister's flat, I think, aunt's flat in North Sydney, to get into our thingamajigs and dirks and that, and we got into a motorboat. I'm not sure about this. I know we went into dock, because one thing I do recall is that in that period, a dockyard matey fell over shipside and killed himself, within a matter of a couple of days of our joining the ship. However, we joined the ship, we walked aboard, trooped aboard the gangway, and we were met by the commander, who then introduced us to, and I was right at the back and didn't get it very well, to a blue-jowled, clean-shaven gentleman, and all I got was Smith, named Smith, and wearing a thick stripe. And this was to be our sub of the gun room. Well, I didn't know much about it in those days, and so I called him Mr. Smith. I thought he was a senior warrant officer. It wasn't. It was Admiral Vat Smith, as it became. So Vat and I weren't so, you know, all that keen on one another for a short time. Then we found in Canberra, we had, as our snotty's nurse, a gentleman called De Chesnel. I don't know how the Navy found such good people, you know. I don't know why we, as a term, were lucky to strike them all the way through, because Dishy was a superb snotty's nurse, very kind, very good. I think, you know, sympathetic and humane anyway. Oh, we were chaste, I mean, we didn't have an easy life. But these were the good people. Then we'd not been in the ship long when the Princess Royal died. And we went into court mourning for, I think it was 13 weeks. Well, although this might seem tragic, it wasn't, because we went to Hobart for the regatta, and as a result of the fact that it was court mourning, there were no official functions. And all the organisations had their own little private ones, which was much more fun. We met so many people down there. We had a wonderful trip in Hobart, and then we left there, went round the south of Tasmania, up to Adelaide, then to Melbourne, back to Sydney. We did a trip then to Jervis Bay, and then Mears and I left in late July, early August of 1936 to go to England to do our courses, while the remainder of the term stayed in Canberra, and indeed I think split towards the end of that year between Canberra and Australia when she returned from the Med. Now, what have I told you? I think I've told you, firstly, these quirks of fate. Now, there's another quirk of fate. You look at that other 12 who were selected, Brazier, who left on passing out, became an RC priest. Burnett went, joined the army when war started. Catlin, I told you about, went. Davies went after his first year. Davis was killed very early in the war. McFarlane was the twin of Admiral McFarlane, who's recently retired from our inn, the paymaster. One was picked, the other wasn't, for the Naval College. The one that wasn't picked for the Navy, for Naval College, joined the Navy during the war. His brother was killed in the Midget submarines in the attacks on Tirpitz. And Allen's carried on and has become an admiral in his own right. Seddon, another member of that term, died of a tumour in the brain about 15 years ago. Shimon died of the dread disease about 5 or 6 years ago. Trelaw lost during the war. Wheel went out of Naval College in his third year, joined the army. He did survive. Wells, the only surviving member of 12 young men to reach admiral, and indeed to get higher rank apart from Shimon, who reached commodore. So why is it, you know, if my 12, our 12, you had one vice admiral, three admirals, one commodore, one captain. Of the others, one was a commander before he retired, two others were lieutenant's commander before they went for highly personal reasons. One of them left us at sea as a midshipman. When the war came, he joined the Air Force, finished up as a flight lieutenant. And this, to me, has been one of the quirks of fate. Why was that 12, the 12 older? And indeed also, David Stevenson's date of birth, 16/8/18. David Wells was only 3 months younger than David Stevenson, November. I, indeed, was only 6 weeks, I think it was, older, or 8 weeks older than the youngest member of the term 2 years ahead of me. Namely Eric John Peel, 30th November 16, so that's correct, it's 7 weeks. But we were there, we were isolated, the term ahead of us for some reason, the Bergens, Cooks, Hinchliffson people, they achieved captain's rank, acting captain's rank and so forth, they didn't get there, there was no admiral from that term. There may have been one admiral if R.J. Robertson had made it, but so he was the Melbourne Voyager collision. If Robertson had been made an admiral, there's a distinct possibility that David Stevenson would never have been promoted rear admiral. A distinct possibility. I'm not saying it would have happened, but there is a possibility. So here is this fatalistic thing coming in again. And so we went on. We weren't a particularly, I don't think, a strong term after we left the college and getting together, but we always knew one another. We were always ready to see one another again. Mears and I went to Keirm. Now, in our time at Keirm, we had the coronation review. We went up there in the Hermes as passengers, and while we were there, we ran across Bassett, Brown and Crabb, who were midshipmen in the battleship Baron. I don't think we ran across Jack at that time, the others. I ran across Dollard, Gay and Fenner at a point-to-point race in Dorset in early 1938. So the story straight away came home that Muzzy had gone all funny. He was wearing pink plus fours. I was wearing plus fours, but a very, very tasty set of Irish tweeds, but still. They weren't pink. They were heather-coloured. Anyway, that story got home. That was all they knew about me in Australia when I came back here. I saw them then. We came back to Australia, Mears and I, in April 1940, joined Canberra after leave. In June 1940, Bill Dovers was in Canberra. Bill left Canberra within days to go overseas. So that was the last we saw of him. Where have I got it? Sorry, this is where I need to refresh my memory a little bit. So, all right, 1940, aren't I? Yep. 1941. No, 1940, I saw John Mears a few occasions in the Perth. We were in Fremantle together once. I saw Gay that time. That was the only time I saw Gay before Perth went. I saw John on leave in Sydney one time. 1941, I ran across Ed Dollard. 1942, after the Canberra was sunk, I was in Usher's Hotel in Sydney, and up came a gentleman dressed as a flight sergeant in the Air Force, Penny, on his way up to being a flight lieutenant, the only time I saw him after I left the college. 1943, I don't think I saw much of my term in 43, except I went down to FND and stayed with one member. I think it might have been Bill Dovers. No, that was 44. No, I went down with Bungie Williams, with Rolf Williams, and I met somebody there. I don't know where you were then.
43.
Yeah, I think it might have been you at FND. Yeah, yeah. 44, yes, I ran across Bill at FND. I stayed with him. I ran across David Stevenson in Aden. He was the navigator of the Hobart. I ran across Bill Dovers in Trincomalee in the quick match. He was in Colombo in the quick match. Rodney Rhodes was his captain. Bill was on his way home at last to get married to Ray, who'd been wondering where in the heck he was, had been for about 3 years. 1945, Napier, Steve, Crabb and Bimbo, at the end of the war. I was in Nizam. We served together. We entered Tokyo Harbour together. 1946, Shropshire. Oh, no, 1945, came back to Sydney and I found Ed Dollard as First Lieutenant of the Warramunga and Thomas Fenner in First Lieutenant of the Q. 46, joined the Shropshire, Bertie Bassett was there as a torpedo officer. And indeed, we went up to Japan together in the occupation forces. I think it was 46 we had a reunion and Nipper Crabb celebrated his first engagement. You were there. In Romano's. I think six of us were there. That was the first time we'd been together as in any quantity for since we left the college. 1948, Shropshire again. I ran across Arnold Holbrook Green. I'd served with him during the war in the ends, by the way. 1949, no, not a great deal of contact with my term. 1950, I ran across Dovers, Crabb and Stevenson in the Australia. In Jervis Bay, and Dollard was captain of the Murchison. Then 52, 53, I ran across Steve. 54, 55, Vengeance. Steve was the commander, I was the engineer officer. Flinders Naval Depot, Jack was down there for a while, and then he went overseas just after I joined. But this was the odd thing. We didn't work together as a term, as a lot of others. They seemed to get together. We weren't. We were never in the same place very often. I don't know how the seamen side of it. There seemed to be three of you who were together occasionally, but never any more. I think possibly the way our destroyer flotillas were fragmented during the war, where the ends were all over all the oceans. It really worked to get four in-class destroyers together. And certainly the ends and the Qs never worked together, although we were in the same fleet. These sort of things, I think the small ship time was when you used to get together, that where you were so fragmented, or your time was fragmented, you just didn't have a chance. So now we're getting to a stage, the end of the war, where we came out with one killed, John Mears. Willie Gay had been a prisoner of war, and he decided to take his time and left us. 1946, 47 or so, Fenner went. He had very great family, to grave family problems, and Brown left very shortly after that as a commander. Bertie Bassett retired in about 1951, 52 as a commander. He went to London, I think, didn't he? Yeah. Yeah. And so there we were in 1950. There were still six of us left, and I think by 52, 53, all of us were commanders, those who were left. Yeah, all of us were commanders by then. And then the fun started, because we did see a bit more of one another. And, for example, I had, as I said earlier, David Stevenson and I were together in the Vengeance.
John Crabb and I were together in London. Bill and I were together in London. Jack and I were together at FMD. Jack and I were together at Narimba. I don't think I served with Ed except at Navy office. And he principally was in Canberra then, and I was down on the Melbourne branch before the engineers moved up to Canberra. Steve, I served with a couple of times in odd jobs. Now, it's interesting here, I just jotted down a few things casually the other day, and again, when we came to the crunch point, I said we're all commanders by about 1952. In fact, the ones I noted here, Crabb was made a commander in 51, Dovers, I think, was the first commander of the term in 51. Steve was made a commander in 52. I was made a commander in late 51. Crabb, captain 57. Dovers, captain 57. Stevenson, captain in 58. Musred, captain in 58. And here the big thing comes. The first admiral, Buster Crabb, was made in 1966, 30 years after we'd left the college. Bill Dovers was the second admiral in 67, and David Stevenson the third admiral in 68. And I brought up the rear as the engineer of the team in 1971. Dollard was a commodore around about in the Sydney job, around about 68, 69. Yeah, Dollard was made commodore. Did you serve as a commodore? No. And Jack was a captain, certainly, as captain of Narimba. Well, there you are. I don't know. So I've rambled on. I've taken a lot of time, more than I intended, and I haven't accomplished much. But I don't know if I've given you any ideas. I think my idea, really, is there were several quirks of fate, and I think this happens in any walk of life. It only wants one person to refuse an appointment, and it puts a completely different picture on it. If Shimon hadn't died, and he was junior to me at college, he was in fact senior to me as a captain by 6 months. If Shimon hadn't died, he may have been the admiral and I might not have made it. If Melbourne Voyager hadn't happened, David Stevenson might not have been promoted admiral and wouldn't have become chief of naval staff. But it was interesting, 1972-73 in Canberra, where every board member was a Jarvis year. Peter Peake was a Jarvis year, 4 years ahead of us, and he was chief of naval staff. David was second naval member. I was third naval member. John Crabb was fourth naval member, and Bill Dovers was deputy chief of naval staff. So, you know, we really felt like old home week. Another interesting thing, which I hadn't realized, and I've got to check, but I was reading through Mr. Eldridge's book on the Naval College, I have a suspicion that not only was Peter Peake a Jarvis year, but 4 years ahead of him, the Jarvis year of that time contained my two favourite officers, Plunkett, Cole and Green. Neither of them ever mentioned it, although Plunk did. We organised a reunion in Canberra 40 years on in 1972, and Plunk was our guest of honour. And Plunk did say something to me, which led me to suspect there was some greater relation than he'd ever let on. So maybe he was a Jarvis year man. But you see, the Depression, no entries, then squeezing it up, then the war's coming, then we served World War II, then we had the Korean War come along, you had more room to show your paces and so forth, more sea time, more interesting sea time. All of us, because of the enormous amount of war experience, war service we had and experience we got, were promoted comparatively early, so we were getting into the swing of things. All this, I think, helped to make the Jarvis year what it became. I won't say any more.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.